You're listening to Seminary Dropout, and I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. In cooperation with MissioAlliance.org, straight from my house in Austin, Texas to yours, interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers, because good theology should be for everyone. This is Seminary Dropout. Let's go! My guest today is Michelle Higgins. Michelle is the Director of Faith for Justice in St. Louis. Late last year, Michelle spoke at Urbana 2015, one of the largest student mission conferences in the world. Her sermon was talked about online for months after the conference ended. Some found her words controversial, and others found their hearts stirred.
Who am I without you? What am I without the narrative which gave me life, the story of God? In a lot of ways, I'm proud to just be standing here quoting stuff to you. It might sound like some new ideas, but what I did is I read the Bible and then I said it back at you. Is that okay? That's what a good preacher does.
Michelle, thanks for being with me.
My pleasure.
You grew up in St. Louis, is that right?
That's right. We moved around a little bit. My father was in the military, moved around a little bit, but North St. Louis, Central St. Louis, and now the South Side, all of St. Louis City, I consider to be my home.
I've visited St. Louis a few times, but don't know a whole lot about it. But I do know that race has played a big role in the city for a long time, historically, not just, what people think of in the last couple of years or so.
That's very true. Sadly, the history of racism in St. Louis goes back a long way to different redlining. So the impact on housing and then the impact on education and, of course, the impact on job opportunities. Race is a central factor in all of those and has been for at least 100 years, if not actually almost all of the 200 years that St. Louis has been around.
You mentioned redlining, and that's, for those who don't know, that has to do with housing and steering people of color to certain neighborhoods and not letting them out. And those effects are still really, really apparent in St. Louis today.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we have the impact of deed covenants, which is what redlining was attributed. Redlining is sort of the new phrase for the old school covenant that a homeowner would make to the person he or she was selling to. They would say, if you take this home, the only thing you have to promise is that you will never sell to a person who has brown skin or black skin. And so there were Latino, Native, and black people who were all impacted by deed covenants. And even today, real estate is, first of all, directly connected to the value of education. So the value of the homes in your neighborhood lets the government know how much money they're going to give to public schools. But also the value of the homes in your neighborhood is directly connected to the type of person who lives in that house. It's extremely racist practice, and real estate agents, some are trying to break out of that, dismantle sort of that supremacist notion, but many of them just fall into it because the safety that some people of color feel is more important almost than breaking these practices. They say, you know what, if I'm not going to be safe in Lake St. Charles, then I'm not going to move there. If I'm not going to be safe in Creve Coeur, then I'm not going to move there. This is not for us, really. It's not about knowing where we belong. It's about knowing where we will be treated as humans, as neighbors.
I'm curious, do you have a lot of preaching background?
Preaching background. I am the daughter of a preacher. I'm the daughter of two preachers, if I might say. My mother was an evangelist in the Church of God in Christ. My father he's the former Sunday school superintendent of West Germany in the Church of God in Christ. And I don't know a day when literally I was not at church growing up. I was just talking about this with someone last night. We were at church every day. And I don't know if I would trade it. I think I would have traded the length of some of them services, but But having absorbed so much preaching, and not only preaching, but bearing witness, the testimony service that's so beloved and teased about in Black church communities, just letting the mothers get up and sing and the deacons lead in the devotional. Yeah, I think in terms of an actual preaching background, we all would define that in so many different ways that I have to say, if you know about the Pentecostal church or the historic Black church, then you would know, yes, I have a preaching background. But if you're thinking standing up in the pulpit every Sunday, having prepared an exegetical speech or being ready to hold forth on specifics of biblical passages, then that kind of background is not mine in my personal experience, but it is mine in the shared, the collective experience, which is how most minorities operate, right? We share the worship experience. When one person is preaching, everybody else is talking back to them. So in our different cultures and in the different ways that we worship, preaching background could be defined so broadly. But I would say, yes, I do.
When you spoke at Urbana, you opened with a song. That's how you came on stage.
Hold on. Yes. They call it pulling a Brenda, because Dr. Salter McNeil did that a few years ago, not long.
You gotta love Brenda Salter McNeil.
I adore her, yes.
You can't not.
Hold on. Just a little while longer, everything will be all right. Hallelujah. Everything will be all right.
Were you nervous speaking at Urbana? That's a pretty big crowd.
Oh my goodness, that's a hard question too. Yeah, I mean, just the short answer, of course. I mean, yes, right? It's a lot of people. It's a lot of folks. So the what was behind the nerves, one of the things that was behind my nerves was absolutely the knowledge, the understanding that young people are the battery pack. They are the engine of any movement. I believe that Urbana Missions is a movement. I believe that InterVarsity, and these are self-identified traits, right? These folks call themselves, this is a movement. And I believe the opportunity to invite partnership with another critical movement made me so nervous, because I had the chance to bring forth an invitation in cooperation with so many others who wanted to bring an invitation as well. I think of Erna, I think of actually Una Lucy Lee, who is the reason that I came to Urbana. But I was presented with this opportunity, and they didn't make it a task. They made it a chance. They made it a platform for me to invite people into a story that I believe must be told in order for the United States to truly experience healing, in order for the North American continent to truly experience healing, and therefore any missionary from North America to truly be a lover of image bearers. So my nerves really were so big, in part because the opportunity was so big, but certainly not because I had any doubts or concerns about my message.
Did you anticipate the response that you got? Not so much, you know, immediately when you're on stage from the crowd. It sounds like everybody pretty much loved it there. But the response, good or bad, that you got afterwards online in the weeks, months after that, were you surprised?
I was so thankful for the commitments and the encouragements and the stories that people felt comfortable sharing with me, that I didn't really have time to be surprised in terms of shocked or overwhelmed. But one thing that did open me up to receive just the full capacity of people's flooding responses. And this is just talking about the positive ones, or even the honestly ignorant or honestly inquisitive responses. One thing that opened me up was this chance that I had to speak at a seminar with my dear friend and brother, Howie Melosh. We spoke at a seminar together after the general session in which I spoke. So we met so many people the day after, and we got a lot of face-to-face. So I was prepared a little bit, I think, for how people responded. There was a bit of surprise to me in terms of the negative response with how vicious some people chose to be in terms of informing me that I might as well not be a mother, suggestions that I might opt to commit suicide over some of my views, and then suggesting that I don't know what reconciliation is because I came to divide, I came to incite. And so those reactions surprised me in how vicious, how aggressive they were, and often how personal they seemed. But in terms of being shocked and overwhelmed, I think the better word for describing the positive reactions would be flooded in a really beautiful way. To me, it felt like I was just meeting family members that I hadn't known about. I was just meeting more brothers and sisters, more siblings in the faith, getting to see and really interact with physically, right? So you get so many hugs and selfies. I mean, this is what I love about 20-somethings. They're so ready to befriend and to share. And that, I think, in the end, didn't surprise me, not because of what I said, but because of the fact that something I said, all that I said, was a repetition of what God has already said. And that is, it's never a surprise when people respond to the heart of God.
When I first heard that Mike Brown had been killed, whoo, his blood cries out from the ground. Amen. When I first heard that our brother had been killed, we began looking for churches to host discussion groups. Our church, South City Church in the house, began looking for spaces to hold conversations on race and justice. And all of our evangelical partners, we're going to go right in. Is that okay? All of our evangelical partners said, we're not ready to talk about race and justice. We're not ready to talk about police brutality, mass incarceration. We're not ready to talk about the fact that black bodies are grotesque to us. We don't want to admit that. That's a part of our story. We've blanked out. What happens when we edit our story? What happens when we fall in love with being comfortable and being correct? The Lord warns us against this type of editing, doesn't he? Deuteronomy chapter 7, verses 6 and 7, he says, look, I love you, and that's why you're special. You ain't big. You ain't the stuff. Dr. Eric Mason says, you ain't done nothing cute to make God love you. He loves you, thus you have dignity. He made you, thus you have dignity. People of faith, we declare with our mouths that it is God who defines dignity and the aspects therein. Flourishing, justice, abundant life. We say God alone decides this. We say it, but how human history has betrayed us.
What do you think that was about it that connected so well with people?
I can hope, I can say what people have told me, and then I can say what I hope. Because not everyone says, here's where I connected. But sure, the people who do really, really let me know. And many of them have said that Black Lives Matter as a movement, as a decentralized network of people who are striving to decriminalize blackness in America, right? Black Lives Matter is not an implicit only that tags on to that. It is an implicit too. So Black Lives Matter as well. Right. Black Lives Matter as much as. And for them to hear the notion that no one is asking for this clean slate, run of all laws and to have full immunity from everything, to understand that what we are asking for is fairness. That was new to people, or it was a good reminder to people. Second, there was an opportunity for people who have never thought about the Black experience to enter into the experience of an African American. And hopefully the manner in which I spoke informed them that they were welcome to be in relationship with me. The other thing that I've noticed, or at least that I had hoped people heard, was the liberty that is offered in relinquishing our power and privilege, the liberty that the Lord offers us in creation, and then even obviously in covenant, where God is acting and we're not passive, but we're not the powerful one in covenant with God. And hopefully the manner in which I was able to communicate, especially to my majority culture brothers and sisters, that they are free from having to get things right, from having to be perfect, and from having to be the center of every story. There's a freedom in that. And I believe, and I have heard from a few students at least, that them hearing that really encouraged them to pursue that, the liberation, the beauty of interdependence across cultural lines, an intentional interdependence that says, how can I decrease so that God's testimony might increase, and therefore the testimonies of people who look and sound and have lived very different than I have, in a different way than I have. So those are the places where I can only hope and pray that folks are being really sincere when they tell me that's what resonated. The piece that I want, if I could say, you know, what do I want people to take away from everything I said? At the end of my speech, I talked about how we are the evidence. The people of God, people of faith, are the evidence that the sure end that is promised to us, the renewal of all things, the consummation of the cosmos in its creator, we are the evidence that that is coming. And I want our brothers and sisters, our siblings, and our mothers and fathers in the faith to keep in mind that we act and we move and we witness and we testify because we know the end. And as the family of God, we must physically be the evidence that Jesus, who is in a body, although not in human form among us, he has made us his ambassadors, his human form on earth today, to show forth the faith that we sup on, that sustains us, our physical body, standing in between the dividing walls. You know how Jesus took his body and placed it in to destroy the dividing wall of hostility? That's now our job. That's our job. We are now the evidence of that justice that is yet unseen, of that beauty that we are longing for, that we know exists, but so many of our family members in humanity, and the family of just humanity, not even the church, so many of them don't know that that could be possible. And so it is the job, it's the duty, the delight of the people of faith, the people in God's house, to go out and to be the evidence that justice is coming and the reign of the governance of peace will be eternal. So my hope is that somebody in that crowd was made or inspired to determination. Somebody thought, they heard something I said and thought, I can now participate in a resilience that will get me through any challenge, anybody hating me, any sort of hindrance or depression I might face. My hope is that someone was able to commit to an action that seemed difficult, but that after hearing me speak, or even hearing Erna after I spoke, somehow they were inspired to embrace a difficult call as a call to a delightful and enriching mission, a mission that means they decrease and they are actually at the same time made more of the human that God made them to be.
Black Lives Matter is a statement of tension. And oh, how this causes us a little bit of trouble, brothers and sisters, because we talked about that peace, that comfort that overwhelms us. We're addicted to it. It's that side piece, that part-time lover that I can't quite get rid of. I'm comfortable. And it leads me to indifference. What is indifference? It's an absence of activism. Yes, it's my evangelical church partner saying, I'm not ready to have a conversation on race. It's my own friends telling me just blatantly, I don't even know what I would do if my child married outside of my race. I would be weirded out. That indifference, that inactivism is not hate, but it is not love. And thus, it is an enemy.
I mean, I think of some things in my life that were hard for me to swallow at some point, but because someone that I trusted and someone who came from my point of view, most likely being a believer, but because they said it, it was easier for me to accept. And I really wonder if you were that person for some people in that speech, because I think that there are some white folks out there that just, they really will listen and they really will be open-minded. They just don't have the knowledge yet. Like, they just haven't been told. And I mean, I can think of, you know, reading some blog post or a book or something like that about race. And, you know, at some point it being really, really uncomfortable. Even if I knew it was true, it was really uncomfortable. And then there's been times where I will go back to that sometime later and I wonder what I was so uncomfortable about because I have been educated about so many things. It's no longer uncomfortable. It's no longer controversial. It's something that I just know and I accept now. And I really wonder if you were that person for some people that night. I think that that's, my guess is it's probably the case.
I hope so. Yeah. I mean, there's so many of us who, especially when Michael Brown and then more locally, Von Derrick Myers were killed, there were so many people who said, I wish that fill in the blank would say something in the Presbyterian circles. I wish Tim Keller would give a speech and then we would know what to do. I mean, I actually heard people say that, right?
Oh my gosh.
So if we could get the gurus to say what we should do next. But the answer really is in people interpreting the word that we already have. We know what to do. Isaiah 58, right? We know what to do. Micah 6, right? We know what to do already. And I think sometimes it just takes someone, even though someone that we just met, but maybe the manner in which we communicate to each other. This is why we say all the time in Faith for Justice, speaking the truth in love is love. And if that is my goal, is to participate in deep abiding love. So we study a lot of Dr. King and we really hold forth especially the biblical interpretation of an urgency for justice that he preached on. But we are convinced that if we can continue and repeat God's story, then we will realize that we have had all the answers all along. We need only to get rid of our preconceived notions about cultural Christianity, about the Christianity that different empires and governments throughout the years have taught us what Christianity is. African Americans have sort of a jump on this. Our Native brothers and sisters have a little bit of a jump on this. We have seen what white supremacist Christianity it wants us to believe. We have had to interpret on our own what the Bible actually says. And so we have the opportunity now to invite our white brothers and sisters to do the same. The dismantling of the non-religion that is Americanized and for some people Westernized supremacist Christianity, to dismantle that, it takes the people who are descended from those who put it in place. And that's a hard thing to hear. And that's why I believe if we're going to speak that truth, we have to speak that truth in a very loving way.
I think, too, there's an element in your sermon that is bringing people from racism and privilege 101 to something a little bit deeper than that. I mean, you know, you mentioned someone who had said if their children married someone of a different race, they wouldn't know what to do. I think most of us hear that and we know, like, it's pretty obvious, like, that's pretty messed up, you know?
Right.
And so there's a lot of people who are at that level. And then, you know, there are people who, you take something like when people say that they don't see color, and you kind of, there's a logic there, like, you get why, how people got there.
Right.
And they had good intentions. But once you go a little bit deeper, and if you have conversations with people of color, if you read books that were written by people other than white men, you realize that how wrongheaded saying something like that is. And I think there's a real element to the things that you said that were calling people to a deeper understanding than basic privilege 101. You talk about white supremacy, and I think that's so hard for a lot of white folks to to picture anything other than the KKK when you say that.
That's right.
And it's so hard for some, because when they hear that, they think this person is calling, is saying that, you know, that we're implicit in or participating in, you know, burning crosses and white hoods and things like that, and not really understanding the real definition of white supremacy, a culture that is supreme.
Exactly. Yeah, and how easy it is to fall into something that you have become, that one can become convinced doesn't have an impact on anyone else, right? So this is the central problem in the understanding of whiteness in the United States, which is so recent. Remember the, or if folks who have studied U.S. history, just to hone in on our country, because we can't deal with everything in the next 10 minutes, right? But to hone in on our
get country, our house in order first.
That's right. We had Mediterranean Exclusion Acts. We had local civil laws about Irish men and women, about people from Germany. We have had a lot of anti-people laws that were directly connected to ethnicities. There was a time when if you were Irish, there was no way in the world you were going to marry anybody who was Italian, right? But somehow, because of Black and brown-skinned people, or because of the necessary subjugation of people who looked a certain way, and that's including our Asian family members as well, right? Somehow because of that, it became more beneficial, more secure to get rid of Italian, Greek, German, Irish, Syrian, even Armenian. It became more beneficial to just call oneself white. And when that happened, everybody lost something. Even the people who were making the choice, they chose to be colorblind amongst people who shared some piece of the spectrum of their own skin color. But they lost in that, because the thing that they were bowing down to was artificial. Power directly connected to race is artificial. And yet, because that is the way things are in the United States and has been since the US government was created, even on the land, belonging to a totally different group of nations of peoples. Because that's the way we started things, that's the way things have always been. Because there have been fewer and fewer testimonies and stories of the outright trauma and murder and incivility done against those whom we've already decided are less than humans, because we can't see it, because we don't hold on to our history in order to learn from it, we have become convinced that any cultural influence that occurs over and above our interpretation of our own religion really is harmless. And so we're in a space where demanding certain creeds, certain styles of songs be the proper way to worship, we're in a space where that doesn't seem racist or supremacist, because we're in a space where in so many of our conservative churches, women are not allowed to take up the offering or pass out communion. We don't stop and think, oh, that's sexist. That's not actually in the Bible. A woman can't greet you at the door of a church. That's ludicrous. But because our cultural influence demands it, yeah, it is becoming more and more clear to so many of, especially people in minority cultures, it's become so clear that we are actually worshiping white supremacy, or to change it and make it a bit of a more accessible term, right? We're actually worshiping culture more than we would bow down in the presence of our God, to face the fact that creeds, that even some of our confessions that we use in churches were all constructed from a European point of view, is not bad. It's not bad to face that fact. But it is bad when we only look to interpretations, perspectives, creeds, and cultural practices that were born in Western Europe to help guide us in the worship of a God who chose to send his son as a Palestinian, most likely brown-skinned man. We have to grapple with these things. And I'll tell you the truth, we really can't be people of faith who are trying to dismantle racism in the political realm. I can't attempt to dismantle implicit bias in my local police force and then go to church on Sunday, Wednesday, or Saturday afternoon and worship a God in a way that a white male has commanded that I worship. Now, that's probably hardest for my white brothers to hear, because the majority culture makes them think that everything is their personal responsibility. But that is the beauty of Christian unity, and that I can come out and say, this is something we can all do together. So, and that's one thing. I spoke to one gentleman who said, every time you said white supremacy, this is right after I spoke, every time you said white supremacy, he said, I felt like you were calling me personally, Richard, sure, whatever his last name was, a racist.
Yeah.
And I said, that is the interesting thing about what culture, the weight, the yoke, we say in the Black church, the yoke that culture puts upon your neck. You have to get a certain amount of education. You have to sell your house for a certain amount, or you better have a house that's a certain square footage. I have never been so convinced that millennials are at a beautiful point in history where they can begin to testify about the utter pointlessness of particular achievements, of worshiping particular achievements. I think achievement is good, but if we worship it, then we're in trouble. And our young people, this is why Urbana is critical. Our young people have to know and then have to share that the idolizing of achievement is detrimental not only to our personal walk with God, but to unity. Because if I, as a Black woman who has experienced patriarchy and supremacy, if I can't tell my white brother, please be careful that you don't participate in patriarchy and supremacy. If I can't say that to him without him thinking I'm blaming him personally for the whole history of racial terror, then something, there's something between us blocking us that is actually artificial. And so my message, what I hope has become clear, is that our opportunity is to focus on the only real power we can be sure of. And that's not our personal power to achieve, our personal power to control. That's a big one. You know, you could have a whole podcast series on that. Our personal power to control, or to presume that others will do what we want, even if we ask them nicely, even if we give them a perk. I believe that our time as people of faith is to say we will only be able to inspire change in the political and civil arenas if we deal with the crap and the division that we are causing and participating in inside our own households. And by household, I mean our households of faith, our church bodies, our governments that control how we worship and what is okay to do or not do inside of our churches.
That was the things that you're referring to there. That was one of my favorite things about what you said. You didn't say it explicitly at Urbana, but the idea, and if I got it wrong, tell me, but the idea that just tomorrow, I mean, before even a vote is cast at the ballot box, if just tomorrow, if Christians acted like Christians tomorrow, if Christian police acted like Christians, if Christian judges, politicians, and just all of us in what we do. Hey, I'm a realtor by day. If just that.
Yes.
You spoke to earlier. Just people, businessmen, you know, blue collar workers. If we just all acted like Christians, if we gave up that achievement that you talked about and decided that maybe some of us could afford to adopt a few children, like our problems go away. Like before.
So fast.
Yeah. I love that because we kind of, I'll be careful because I'm going to go on a soapbox if I'm not careful, but like we really just lose our minds at election season. And the thing is, I mean, I think that there's one in particular dangerous person running for president. I'm not going to be shy about that, but but whomever our president is, they are not king of the world. If we as Christians in whatever we are, in whatever little power we have, just act like Christians, we change things tomorrow.
Absolutely.
So I want to talk a little bit about your role at Faith for Justice. And if you could just talk a little about what you do and then what the organization is as a whole.
Yeah. So I'm the director of Faith for Justice. We're only about 2 years old. We started, as a lot of folks have guessed rightly, we started not long after the deaths of Michael Brown and Von Derrick Myers in St. Louis. And we are local, intentionally local to St. Louis City, but we have a number of members who live in the counties, especially the counties to the west and to the north of the city of St. Louis. As many people know, St. Louis has so many municipalities that it's almost hard to focus on just city problems, but Faith for Justice does strive to do that in the ways that a number of our allies and partners in Ferguson are striving to focus on the needs and the challenges in Ferguson and the municipalities to the north of the city of St. Louis. So Faith for Justice has this slogan. We like to say we are continuing the story of biblical activism. We are convinced that the church in its early stages in the New Testament was a group of people who had to radically commit to truth-telling, and they had to do so in community. And that means educating and equipping one another, but also challenging our own worshiping bodies and the way that we practice the faith, the way that we testify to the faith. So with that said, Faith for Justice is a group of diverse people from different backgrounds and different denominations. There are about 20 churches represented right now, hoping for lots and lots more. But we are all a people of the Christian faith. Our membership is all people of the Christian faith. And that's our main tier of participants. Second, each person in Faith for Justice is committed to crossing dividing lines to partner with people. So each of us is committed to civil disobedience in partnership with people who are not saved by grace, or with people who hate the church, with people who have been abused by the church. We intentionally partner with these folks if they'll have us, and we intentionally stand shoulder to shoulder, side by side, with people with whom we may never see eye to eye. And we do this because one of the other things we say is that if God has not revealed to us the status of anyone's soul, then we don't have a right to presume whether or not God will smile on them. In fact, we believe that the Lord smiles on all who bear his image. And so we're very serious about dignifying human life as sacred, as good, under God. So with that, we have a main platform of dismantling racism in the city of St. Louis and the different courts, the court system, especially in law enforcement and local police, and especially among particular neighborhoods that are divided by race. So we do a lot of work on the south side of St. Louis, which is a place that is being gentrified, but it's also really beginning to crumble education-wise. A lot of our Southside schools are crumbling. And then we do work with partners on the north side of St. Louis, which is predominantly Black. But a lot of the oversight, a lot of the dismissal and the ignorance of neighborhood and community issues that's happening on the north side really is because no one at City Hall is paying attention. And we are more and more convinced. In fact, there have been a few studies that have convinced us further that people don't pay attention to the north side of St. Louis because it's predominantly African American. And those, to us, are biblical issues. That is a justice issue that can be directly impacted by faith communities. Any justice issue that can be impacted by a community of faith is a justice issue that we either take up a platform for on our own. So we might start a platform. We have a voting rights and registration platform we're doing in 2016. Or we might find people who are already working. This is a really important piece of what Faith for Justice does. We never presume to lead. In fact, humility as the key to solidarity is one of the major things that my friends and I on the organizing team for FFJ, we go around and we tell people humility is the only way you're going to get to solidarity. It's like a mantra. So we never presume to be the first to anything. And that has really helped us to find partners who've been around for decades that we just haven't heard of them. And we go in and we say, we want to serve. That's it. We want to learn. We want to serve. And that's been a wonderful opportunity to decriminalize Blackness in St. Louis. That is probably the biggest issue, especially on the north side of our city, is that being brown-skinned or Black is considered criminal without consideration. 100% of the people who were stopped for jaywalking in the past 5 years are Black. Mm. No one gets ticketed for jaywalking. And yet in St. Louis, if you do get a ticket for jaywalking, guaranteed you're brown skinned or you're Black. This is a real problem. And the communities of faith that exist around our city, and there are over 300 churches in St. Louis, which is shrinking, we still have 300 churches in the city limits. These churches need to be mobilized. They need to be radicalized to truth-telling. They need to be radicalized to a humility that would denounce being judgmental. And like you said, they need to be radicalized to inform the people who go to their churches that in whatever job you're in, if you would consider yourself an ambassador, if you would consider yourself the evidence of Jesus' coming reign of peace, then you could make change in little to no time at all.
We'll have links to Faith for Justice on the show notes of this for the listeners. So anybody in St. Louis, if you want to see how you can join in and what they're doing, you can. We'll be sure to direct you there. Michelle, it's been so good talking with you. I have to emphasize to the listeners just how big your talk was at Urbana. I mean, that is what people were talking about. And I think for the people that weren't there, tons of people did not even know about it until they heard about your talk. There were blog posts written and responses to those blog posts written.
If you believe that the brother or sister who is next to you but doesn't share your skin tone is equal to you in every way, if you believe that there is only one race on earth physiologically, that's right, I see you, y'all equal. If you believe that there's only one race on earth physiologically, then you already believe that. Say, I believe. I believe that we will win. Say, I believe.
So, you know, after I heard your talk, I really wanted to talk with you. And so it's been so good too. And thanks for being here.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
We will win. Look at your neighbor. Say, I believe. I believe that we will win. Everybody say, I believe that we will win. I believe that we will win. Woo! Give God some praise.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code SeminaryDropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah.